we got the Attorney General, Mike Verity here, and Deputy AG Jim Cantor. Review on Department of Law, and
I gotta tell you, I know you've been through this drill before because I've been to some other overviews, and that's probably the case with some others on the committee. And I kind of apologize for the repetition, but I think it's good, and it gives the committee a chance to ask any questions as we go here, maybe, if they come up. But if you would, introduce yourself and go right ahead. And with us today, we have Representative Ledoux and Representative Millett and myself, Representative Keller.
I expect to be more joining us later. So go ahead, Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Gowdy. I'm the Attorney General. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and give an overview of the Department of Law, which I have addressed with others before, and so I'm going to try to switch it up a little bit and try to avoid repetition. But you know, for you and other members of the committee, please interrupt. I'm happy to answer questions on areas if I gloss over them unintentionally. But the department, it organizes itself around four core functions, which I didn't draft these, but I certainly looked at them closely, and I do think they capture the essence of what we do, which is to protect the safety and financial well-being of Alaskans, to foster conditions for the responsible development of our natural resources, to protect the fiscal integrity of the state, and to promote good governance. If you look at our budget, over 60% is devoted to the protecting Alaskans, which is our law, our prosecution arm, you know, criminal section of the Department of Law. We have over 13 offices in the state staffed by assistant district attorneys. And if you look at Alaska as a state and recognize the vast area that we encompass and our responsibility as citizens to prosecute criminals and the like, I mean, it's a mammoth undertaking in a state that lacks infrastructure, roads, transportation is taken for granted everywhere else, villages, far-flung villages, witnesses who have to be transported, law enforcement, I mean, it's a mammoth undertaking, and so it does consume a significant part of our budget. Last year, the criminal section handled over 40,000, or close to just under 40,000 matters. That includes over 20,000 misdemeanors, over 8,000 felonies, as well as criminal appeals, extraditions, juvenile matters, petitions for post-conviction relief, and the like. And so those aren't dispositions, but those are open matters that required some degree of attorney attention in the sense of either screening the case or taking it to trial or appeal, whatever the case may be. So in a very significant part of our budget, we have the seven offices, or seven of the 13 criminal offices also house civil attorneys, and those would be the other sections, or the core services I mentioned about protecting our fiscal integrity, good promoting good governance, and fostering natural resource development. You know, in that particular area, a lot of what we do is litigation to protect our right to develop our natural resources, whether it's under a challenge from the agencies of the federal government, or whether we have been successful in complying with what the federal government requires and protecting it from challenges from non-government organizations who are seeking to overturn the federal action or court action, whatever the case may be.
There's a question from Representative Millett. Before you ask it, I want to acknowledge Representative Greenberg. Welcome. He came about 3 minutes after we started.
Thank you. So I have a question on litigation against the federal government. What determination, I mean, how do you determine what you're going to litigate and what you're not going to bother with? I mean, is there some type of group, working group you have that looks at?
Well, I would say there is an informal working group. I mean, we do meet periodically with the representatives of the various sections, section leaders, natural resources, environment conservation, oil and gas, my deputy, myself, to look at representatives from transportation section, because it's such a, it's an area that crosses many disciplines that we do. And it just depends on what it is, what's at stake. You know, this summer we fought a lawsuit against the federal government over an enactment of this emission control area off Alaska. And that was one we looked at long and hard. It's a very difficult case, but, you know, that's going to increase the cost of goods to Alaskans, period. I mean, it's a tax on Alaskans. And in August 2015, it's going from this 1% sulfur fuel to ultra low sulfur fuel, which is even more expensive. So it's 90% of the goods consumed by 85% of all Alaskans come through the Port of Anchorage. So it's it can only increase the cost of goods. So that's one where we balanced a very difficult case, I think, against the consequences for all Alaskans in a state that already has one of the highest cost of living in the nation. And I just decided I didn't want to sit on the sidelines and let that go into effect. So that's the motion for preliminary injunctions in the process has been filed. The briefing on that is Department of Justice has the last word in there in the process of filing their briefs. Anticipated decision sometime probably this summer. Endangered Species Act litigation has great ramifications for the state because of climate change. That's the new game changer in Endangered Species Act, is climate change and the fact that the government is now projecting 50 or even 100 years out and predicting what's going to happen with these species, ringed and bearded seals, most recently came out for 90-day listing. That's a 100-year model. There's millions, literally, millions of these bearded and ringed seals. But they're in 100 years, projecting on the loss of habitat and so on and so forth. You know, the service has made is going to make a determination that, or could make a determination if, in fact, they're listed as endangered. That they're going to be in danger of extinction. The polar bear is on a 50-year model, and we lost that case. It's currently on appeal. The downside of these decisions in the listing is one thing, but the next step in the process is critical habitat, determining where the critical habitat's going to be, and that has the effect of essentially federalizing state land, because then decisions which used to go to the purview of the state and our permitting agencies. If the Endangered Species Act is threatened and it's within critical habitat, then you've got to jump through a whole set of hoops on the federal side to do whatever development or permit that's required. Now, we just won the federal district court here three weeks ago the decision challenging the critical habitat for the polar bear, which was about 190,000 square miles up the Arctic coast and off the coast. And some of it was areas where polar bears never been, frankly, and that was noted by the judge in vacating the rule. Not just remanding, he vacated the rule. So right now, there is no critical habitat rule for polar bears. But it's going to go through another round, and we're going to have to cross that bridge. This case, I'm sure, will be appealed. But in the end, I represent at one point, so the flip side, I mean, the beluga whales is another species that we lost on the critical habit, on the designation itself. You know, we didn't appeal that. We looked at it. That was shortly after I took this job. And, you know, the numbers of beluga whales are down and have stayed down. So we decided in consultation with the administration that that was just probably not a good case or viable appeal to devote a resource to. So we let that go.
But, even though they're abundant in other areas like Crystal Bay, I mean, I know that we say we have a subspecies in Cook Inlet, but I mean, I think that.
I don't know what the abundance is elsewhere. I know Cook Inlet. I mean, they have as part of the process they divide these species up into distinct population areas or segments. They call them. You know, the Stellar Sea Lion, for example, they were looking at seven areas. in the western, what they call the western DPS, or distinct population segment. And I think six out of the seven areas, the species had actually come back. But in that seventh area, it had been a further decline, and that's where they went off on the stellar sea lion. So I don't claim to understand the science. We work very closely with Fish and Game on it, and we're in the process of trying to hire some experts ourselves to work on these modeling issues, because I'm convinced that there's another side of the coin there, and another side to the story that we're trying to develop, not just for purposes of cases we have pending, but because I think climate change is the new model that's going to start impacting Alaska, because we have many species reliant on sea ice, for example, in Arctic conditions. But I think it's also going to be impacting the lower 48 as well. So I hope that answers your question. But that's, anyway, we go through a decision-making process. There's nothing reflexive or about it at all. It's a measured process for each case.
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Just one bad, from a personal perspective, I hated to see that we didn't pursue the beluga whale thing, but I serve on CACFA, the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, and our executive director, who's been working on these issues for a long time, related to federal, I'm going to call it overreach, onto land here in Alaska, he says it's almost unbelievable what's happening now. He's absolutely swamped with the different executive orders and reports that go out, and trying to keep up with this stuff. And there's not enough resources to pursue them all, in my opinion. I mean, there are just all kinds of things out there. So it isn't that I fault you in any way, but just I can't help but add, we called in the department and that's what we do, is we listen to all sides of the thing. We tried to document where they got the original numbers from on the beluga whale population, and the testimony that we got was that the biologist that worked for the state at the time was asked, how many beluga whales are there? He didn't know. He said, I don't know, he wasn't really looking at that, and they pressed him, and he kind of figured out on the back of a napkin, well, this is how many there probably are, who knows, kind of thing. And that's the basis for the whole decision on making that an endangered species critical habitat area and declaring it a species problem in the first place. I want to say that Representative Wynn joined us, and I took a lot of words to just make a comment. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I think you raised another issue, though, which is that under the Endangered Species Act, we as a state are entitled to, we believe, do some testing. And so I can't speak specifically, Mr. Chairman, to the example you give about beluga whales, but obviously, there is a science involved. There's tagging, and one of the frustrations we've had is that, according to Fish and Game, we've tried to get permission before to do testing when these listing decisions come up, because it's specifically authorized under the Act, and they've refused it because we have something called the Marine Mammal Protection Act that we have to deal with. So they're subject to that, and so when we ask about permission to do tagging and other kinds of activities like that, they turn us down, and the guys that, the Marine Mammal Protection Act forbids testing and this kind of stuff you want to do. So it's very frustrating, but we can do it on independent. I mean, we can do it as a state, and we are doing it with some other species down in the southeast. The archipelago wolf is one example, and others. And so we're trying to be more proactive and trying to get good science to back us up, not just be, dogmatic about issues, the federal government overreach, which everybody's got an opinion about that, but it's a science issue. I mean, to me, we want to attack this on the science, not on the basis of the federal government's ability to regulate in this area, because we all like polar bears, we all value that species, along with these other species, but from endangered species, we've kind of got to the point where it's kind of species that may be endangered 50, 100 years down the pike, and we just think the Act has gotten far away from its original purpose. So, in any event, but that's one example of many. We talked about the Emissions Control Act case we've got going on, the state's lands issues with Sturgeon case that we're joining in, challenging the...
Before we pass from your fish and wildlife discussion, General, you mentioned the Marine Mammal Protection Act. That was federal law that was promulgated between 1971 and 1973. And I was Ted Stevens' legislative assistant then, and I worked on that. I was his guy on that act. I don't remember whether it has to be reauthorized, does it?
I don't know, Representative to the Chair.
And let me then ask another question, if I may. I assume there must have been amendments to that act at various times. Do you know?
I don't know. I assume, but any other piece of legislation, but again, I'm not positive.
The reason I'm asking is because Stevens was the ranking Republican on the Oceans and Atmosphere Subcommittee of the Commerce Committee. And in Congress, they only refer bills to one committee. And that bill was referred to his committee. Fritz Hollings of South Carolina was the chair of the subcommittee. And we had held hearings on it in Nome and all around the place. And one of the main things that Stevens was working on was the Alaska Native exception for genuine Native arts and crafts, which was about a paragraph long in the bill. And we had to have hearings, and those were what the subject of the hearings up in Nome were, where the two senators and I were, and I think some other staff too. I don't recall one way or the other whether there was any discussion on whether states would be allowed to do any testing. I know that it was the intent of Congress to preempt the field generally because they didn't want people just messing around with the animals generally. But that was before the current situation, before global warming, before the pressure of the Northwest Passage and everything else was there. And I would urge you, rather than just litigate, why don't you work through our delegation to see if that particular issue can be revisited? Because it seems to me, with, as I recall, Begich is on that committee now, and I think he may be the chair of the subcommittee with jurisdiction, the Oceans and Atmosphere Subcommittee. Tell him what you want and see if they could take that subject up, maybe as a separate bill, but he should have the horses in that position to do something for you. They have a Fish and Wildlife Committee in the House, but they don't have a separate committee in the Senate because that subcommittee has jurisdiction over all the fish and wildlife issues that they have a whole committee in the House for. And if I can be of any help or anything on that, my memory isn't what it used to be, but I would think that if you want to do some genuine legitimate testing or something like that, that particularly with our senator in the chair, you ought to have a friendly audience. It sounds like a meritorious suggestion, better than litigating.
Well, that's a good point, Representative, and I, we sort of do try to work with the delegation, but that's a good point. It's well taken. I mean, we all know it's kind of difficult to get in out of Congress nowadays. Gridlock there, but as you say, I mean, it can't all be just litigation. It's got to be, if we can seek sensible changes, we should be doing that. So I appreciate the comment.
I might as well reveal that anything I learned on how to amend, I learned there.
Oh.
We can have other discussions at other times. We were able to just get things through the Senate.
That probably is another day's discussion, but an interesting one, I bet.
And, you know, frankly, if some bill comes along, and given the Senate's rules of germaneness, Senate has much more lax rules than the House does. And if a bill comes along and there's a bill that the chair has, a lot of times they ought to be able to just tack that on in committee or on the floor in your court.
I appreciate the suggestion.
Proceed.
Thank you. Another, we're working on is the Voting Rights Act. We've got a case pending to strike down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires us to get pre-clearance from the Department of Justice, we being the state of Alaska, before we can implement any changes to our election laws or precincts or anything like that.
Have the Native corporations weighed in on that?
They have, I believe, sought leave to intervene in the district court case, yes. And as far as I know, they've been granted. I don't even know that we opposed
them. And are they intervening on the side of the state, or are they intervening on the other side?
They're intervening on the other side. They're seeking to keep the preclearance requirement in place and in effect. The case is stayed currently, our case against the federal government, which was fought in August, because the Supreme Court accepted certiorari in the Shelby County case, mm-hmm. which is a county in Alabama that's seeking to set aside Section 5, not on the grounds. Alaska really has very unique grounds for being in that, for being, what I can say, trapped in Section 5. I mean, it's unbelievable, really, how that came to be. It's a travesty, really. But we are in it. We're trapped in it for the foreseeable future. And to try to get a bailout, as they say, is virtually impossible. But Shelby County's got its own case. It's going to be argued in March. And so our case has stayed currently, which you'll be approached the Department of Justice to do that. So we'll wait and see what happens with that case.
There's two questions, but before we go there, if you would, I think you got interrupted. Just go ahead and give us a couple sentences again what the, litigation is and what the trap we're in.
Well, Section 5, again, when the Voting Rights Act of 65 was passed, there was a long and pernicious history of voter discrimination in the southern states who systematically disenfranchised African Americans. It was a shame. And the Congress came along to change the law and prohibit discrimination in voting. Because you can discriminate against someone voting and somebody can go ahead and file suit, but if you have the election under the discriminatory practices or procedures that might be an issue, it's too late, really, to try to get redress. And so Section 5 was created to find the bad actor states and the states who had a pattern or history of violating these voter rights to, before they could make any changes to their election laws, precincts, redistricting, you name it, anything. They had to come in and get permission from the Department of Justice that the particular procedure or change that they were proposing passed muster. And so that's been in effect since 1965. Alaska originally got roped into it because when our Constitution was first drafted, you had to read and write English in order to vote. That was later taken out of our Constitution by amendment, but then you had to have, I don't have the chapter and verse here. I just read our amicus brief again in preparation for this hearing, and I'd be happy to provide something in writing for those members of the committee that are interested, because it really is a tortuous history of how we managed to see it and how Congress keeps reenacting, reauthorizing Section 5. At first it was for 10-year periods, and most recently they did it for 25 years. And so I'd be happy to provide more details in writing, but the thrust of it is, Mr. Chairman, that in the most recent example is our own redistricting, which took place last year for the election just held. And the redistricting board, because we're under this preclearance requirement, the redistricting board wants to come up with a plan that complies with federal law. our constitution is race neutral when it comes to setting districting boundaries, voter districts. And our Supreme Court threw it out and said that wasn't, the plan that was devised did not comply with our constitution. And they sent it back. Another plan was put into place, but at that point it was getting absolutely critical because we weren't going to be able to get this new plan approved because it had to go back to Washington, D.C. So I can't begin to describe the hassle, inconvenience, anxiety that was caused with the Division of Elections. Everybody else wanted, you know, what district am I going to be in? If I'm running for office, nobody knows. And so our Supreme Court approved an interim plan. And that interim plan, and then we got sued by NARF and some other groups who came forward and said, well, by approving that interim plan, you violated Section 5. Well, here our state Supreme Court ordered us to use the interim plan for our purposes of our election, and we've got plaintiffs suing us saying we're in violation of federal law. And we filed a motion for summary judgment to set aside Section 5. And the day after that motion was filed, the Department of Justice pre-approved the interim plan. And so our motion was moot, the lawsuit was moot, and the election went ahead. But that's just a microcosm of what was happening, and it's just unnecessary. And again, I'd be happy to provide more detail for members of the committee. I'm sure the committee people may be curious about it. But I'd be happy, or the copy of our brief. We have a very we did file an amicus brief in the Shelby County case, and it just focuses on Alaska. It's very specific to Alaska and our history. So it's about 72 pages, including exhibits. The brief's about 35 pages. But anybody with an interest in it, I'd be happy to provide that as well. It's an excellent brief, well written, and it lays it out in sufficient detail. So. If you would, that's what it's about.
If you would provide that link to our office and we'll make it available to the committee so we don't have to kill any trees, but it's very good reading. I mean, yeah, it is. I'd commend it.
No, it's very good reading, and I think people read that. If they're interested in the issue and wonder why is the state going after that, and I know I've been challenged by a couple of senators on the Senate Judiciary, and in good faith. You should really read this brief, and I think you get a better handle for why it is we filed that case and why we're pursuing it. But, you know, we also on the same side of the federal government.
We do have a couple questions, I guess.
I'm sorry.
Around Greenberg.
No, I'll yield to Representative.
Is anybody ever concerned that the these districts, which have to be either majority Native or majority African American or majority whatever, actually in a strange way kind of dilute the influence of those groups that they're designed to protect, because then they're never the swing votes in, you know?
Through the chair, I don't know, Representative. I mean, that's not how I think about it. I'm not a voting rights expert or a redistricting expert. I know there's a lot of demographics going to that I don't pretend to understand. But all I know is our Constitution says you devise election districts based upon contiguity, social and cultural characteristics, and so on. I mean, that's about as far as I know. So. And what I read in the decisions, but I'm sorry I can't be more specific on
that. Thank you.
Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, General. Number one, entirely aside from the English-only history of the former constitutional provision, there is one area of Kodiak that is so greatly populated by the Filipino community that the Voting Rights Act applies on that basis alone over there. And as I understand it, and Gabriel, Ms. Ledoux, Representative Ledoux may correct me on this, that they do print ballots in Tagalog. So there are parts of Alaska that legitimately, under any theory, fall squarely under that under the Section 5. And I'd like to hear your views on that. And then I have one more question, Mr. Chair.
Well, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act prohibits discrimination in voting practices and the kind of things that you mentioned. I mean, discriminating against voters and type of ballot language or something. We're not challenging that. So that's okay. That's the thing that violates state law. So the it's a very narrow challenge dealing with Section 5 only, which is the requirements of 15 states that are required.
And some counties, too, are there not?
Well, individual units, I mean, within states, I mean, we can, as a state, we can be, in fact, one of the examples we got roped in is the municipality of Anchorage, they changed a precinct, as I recall, and didn't get preclearance. Well, that was a violation. So violation, you've got to go then 10 years with a clean record before you get out. It's impossible. I mean, it's the bailout, as they call it. It's a bailout provision. Alaska's actually bailed out twice with Voting Rights Act. We're the only jurisdiction that actually bailed out twice. But we get roped back in again when Congress reauthorizes the law again. So, but discriminating against voters on ballots, language issues, that will remain against the law. That's your
advice. If I may interrupt at this, that goes to my second question, which is that because of the growing number of non-Caucasian, non-traditional English, both from the birth rate and from immigration, we now have two states, Hawaii and New Mexico, that are majority-minority, and it's likely within, I think, a few months or a year, California will join them. And I know that we have a lot of folks from other countries, other cultures, coming even into our state. And so there are very legitimate need to protect these folks, many of whom English is not a primary language for them, or even in some cases, their children, people who are born in the United States. Any comment?
Well, you're right, and I think we as a state have to be sensitive and do what we can to provide access to voters and language you're comfortable with. You know, I don't know all the details to represent it, but I know the director of the Division of Elections is extremely conscientious about it. Does a very hard, a good job. He's sensitive to our lieutenant governor as well. So, again, we're not saying we should never be subject to scrutiny by the federal government if we do something wrong, because that's not the case. We should be subject to federal scrutiny, and state scrutiny for that matter, if it's something, because many of these practices are illegal under state law to discriminate on voting. So,
the reason I'm saying,
Representative Greenberg, did you follow up on that?
I could.
Yeah, okay, we just moving along. Go ahead.
I appreciate this, because this is a very important issue.
Very important, and I don't mind a dialogue. I just wanted to make sure on the record what we're doing. Go ahead.
Okay. I think the state and the other states that are involved or interested in this litigation should be thinking about, and that is, if the Supreme Court holds that Section 5 is no longer constitutional because of changed circumstances, I think at that point we will see some interest in Congress, depending upon what the Supremes say, in coming out with something new. And so you folks and we, actually both individually and as Alaska legislator and as members of NCSL and CSG and everything else, ought to be thinking of what the next round of legislation ought to look like in this area. Because given the changing demographics in this country, a problem won't go away if it is a problem. And that is something that, and then there'll probably be another round of litigation. But certainly legislatures, both national and at the state level, and I'm looking at this legislature too, because we have a constitutional responsibility here, as well as a political one, need to be having a plan B if this is struck down.
It's a good caution.
I was just going to respond to one of the things that Representative Bloomberg had said, because I'm intimately familiar with Kodiak, having lived there for over 30 years and having represented Kodiak in the legislature. Most of the Filipinos in Kodiak thought that the ballots printed in Tagalog were absurd, because in the Philippines, English is one of the national languages. Their ballots in the Philippines are written in English. So we had Kodiak, which was basically the only place on earth where ballots were written in Tagalog. This is how far things have swung in an effort to be protected.
Well, John, would you, having just come from the Philippines and having a very difficult time talking to people that know only Tagalog, you're absolutely right. All the signs are in English, you know, advertising, everything else, you know, everything in English.
Through the court, West Publishing Company publishes in their Philippines edition. It is in English. The courts are in English. I actually believe that Parliament is maybe conducted in English in the Philippines. So.
But comment through the chair, I don't disagree, but what's, you know, there's only, like I said, about 15 states that have to go through this pre-clearance. Alaska's one. I mean, there's pockets of minorities in every state, just about. I mean, people flock to America. That's a great thing about America. So, again, how we get stuck in this trap and have to go seek permission from the federal government in these other states, I think, have the same type of issues, Representative, with all respect. It's just that the system is not right. When the last time the Supreme Court heard this case was right before the act was reauthorized again, and they pointed out that things had changed dramatically. And unless Congress reauthorized it with findings showing that there was still a need to go through this archaic process, you know, a number of the justices expressed skepticism that this kind of federal overreach, if I may, was appropriate in a select number of states. And so we'll see where it goes with Shelby County, and we'll be prepared to do whatever we need to do. But we've got a case that I think is great to challenge this case. I don't know all the facts in Shelby County, but I'll supply a brief to the committee and leave it up to the chair's discretion if anyone wants to distribute it. But let me also just mention quickly, because I don't want to convey the wrong impression, that there's a number of cases in which we join with the federal government. I mean, it's not all a one-directional or reflexive that we're against. And the Point Mac entire, the rail extension that the legislature funded, built about 30 miles of rail over Port McIntyre, up to the spur there, the Parks Highway spur, the Surface Transportation Board issued a license to the railroad to build that. They got all their permits, everything else was done, and that was challenged by a number of environmental groups. Actually got an injunction a few months ago. We intervened in that case on behalf of the railroad and on behalf of the EPA, who's defending the Surface Transportation Board. We're on the same side with them. We got that injunction vacated by a Ninth Circuit panel, and that same panel recently affirmed the decision by the Surface Transportation Board. So, you know, when we see the federal government take action with which we agree, those actions are always going to be challenged by this very healthy consortium of environmental groups. Are well funded, they're well intentioned. I mean, not by my lights, but I don't doubt the sincerity of what they're trying to do, and they're well funded, and they're going to challenge these cases. And when Alaska has an interest at stake, we're going to intervene on behalf of the federal agency that's issued the permit, and fight to support that. And if we have resources at stake, so that's happened with Apache Oil. They got incidental harassment authorizations for the beluga whales to do drilling in Cook Inlet. That was challenged by environmental groups. We've intervened in that case on behalf of the Marine Fisheries Service. So there's a number of them.
I want to add to that if I could. We in our work in the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas called CACFA, we found that many of the federal employees, directors, superintendents, and whatever that had been here a long time were really easy and cooperative and worked together and had kind of, pretty good compromise worked out in many cases. But what's happened as the federal government retires folks and turnover and everything, there's always a challenge when new people come and try to run in the same regulations, different interpretations, very frustrating. But you're right. I mean, I my previous comments, I wanted to also add that working with BLM and U.S. Parks, U.S. Forestry, a lot of really good people there, and they're Alaskans. You know, they work for the federal government, but they understand and they work with us. So, Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any effort in Congress being made to change the Indian Child Welfare Act?
Not that I'm aware of.
That's, don't need to pursue it. Thank you. I thought I might have heard something about it.
Well, through the chair, I'll say there's, you may have met, or the Indian, the Congress passed a piece of legislation, can't recall the name now, but as part of that, they created the Indian Law and Order Commission. And the Indian Law and Order Commission has been traveling around the country. They've come to Alaska several times. I met with the chairman several months ago, Carol Goldberg, professor from UCLA.
Really?
He's on the panel. Some other names that you may know, but I'm
not
blanking.
UCLA,
and
I'm familiar with her name.
Well, yeah, very an expert in tribal law, and a number of other experts as well. So they're traveling, and they're going to come up with a report, and we're watching very closely. I just sent them a lengthy letter because I'm concerned about, we don't have traditional Indian country up here, and to try to get that point across with, Professor Goldberg, you fought an amicus brief in the Venati case. We're one of a number of other professors, but the point is we always struggle with that. People who are experts in the subject of the War of 48 don't quite understand the nuances up here in ANSCA and the other. So, in any event, but I'm not aware of changes pending to ICWA, Representative. But anyway, we've got a number of cases federal, and actually, only 10% of our budget is, approximately 10% is economic opportunity resource development. So it's not, in all the cases that I've mentioned here, with the exception of the Endangered Species Act, we do in-house. We've got an enormous wealth of talent that people have been dealing with these issues for a long time, and we've got some great expertise.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. Why was it necessary to go outside for the Endangered Species Act? Was it because you didn't have anybody expert at that? And if so, are they now expert? Are you going to continue to have to use outside counsel?
Well, because that predates my tenure through the chair, but they're a national firm. They do have a lot of experience in this matter. I've got a couple of attorneys who work almost exclusively on this, but the number of cases in, when there's a record of decision associated with a listing or something like this, it's thousands and thousands of pages that need to be reviewed for comments and for purposes of doing a challenge and stuff like that. So it's very labor intensive and time consuming. The law is not rocket science necessarily, but it's new terminology. It's for me, it's been a steep learning curve. But I think it's we have good in-house experience, but those cases are very, very document intensive because of the records of decision, and the record needs to be reviewed and sifted for purposes of challenging these decisions. So, in any event, I wasn't here when we hired these folks, but I met with them. They're very good, and we've had some success. This recent case before the district court judge is striking down the critical habitat for the polar bear. So, but it's something we always look at. I've not read to anything in particular, but it's all results oriented. So,
before I continue, did you finish?
I did. Thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate the latitude.
Are we do you anticipate changes in the way we evaluate environmental litigation? I mean, are we doing, I think we're doing a great job, you know, and I think you're doing a great job. This is not, but I'm wondering, are there things ahead? Do you think we're going to have to rethink this issue?
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I try to keep an open mind, and you know, as you said, it's not. So I don't come at this with a parochial point of view necessarily, and you know, I've tried a lot of cases, I've litigated a lot of cases, so I try to weigh what the interest at stake, weigh the chances of success, and you know, it's an analysis we go through, and I have others take a look at it as well. And so we make a measured decision to challenge these things when they come. Sometimes, in the case of the beluga whale, you know, we're going to keep our powder dry and wait for the next round because, in my view, an appeal would not be worth taking. So I'm going to continue to do that, and that's what I did in 30 years of practice. It's, you know, not everything, you know, chase everything down.
I'm very tempted to bring up a bill, Representative Feige's bill, but I won't do that. We can't do that. We'll press on here with the overview. Please go ahead.
I don't care.
I just soon get the overview.
Okay, thanks.
Well, and I'm you know, we've got a little, just under 300 attorneys now in the Department of Law, and it's about roughly equal between criminal and civil. Again, I was asked whether I perceive a need for you know, our staffing. I think we're adequately staffed. I don't perceive a need for that. We did add 5 new positions this year. One child protection paralegal in Fairbanks, another prosecutor in Fairbanks, another prosecutor and paralegal in Bethel, and another prosecutor for Southeast. And so, you know, with those additions, I think we're well staffed, and you know, I don't see that changing over the future. The other thing, you know, that we do, I think is of some benefit, is we do earn a return on you know, our budget, in the sense that a big part of what we do is, comes to the fiscal integrity of the state, that's making sure everybody pays their taxes and all the royalties are paid, and the, you know, the tariff is not too high for the pipeline and all that other good stuff. So we're very involved in those cases. In fiscal year 2012, we recovered just under $100 million, the Department of Law, and that'd be, part of that, I think, was the, as I recall, the Carlson case, which we had money set aside, and we won that on appeal, and so we had about $68 million, it was less than that, but a substantial amount was released back to the state as a result of winning that Supreme Court case. In fiscal year 2011, we recovered about $146 million for the state. And for fiscal year 2013, that we're in currently, of course, we just won that BP corrosion case to the tune of $255 million in October. So we're already on a very good pace for this year. So, you know, I like to think that we can earn a return, and those won't necessarily happen every year, but we do collect a lot of money for the state, and we pursue a lot of claims on behalf of the state against the oil industry and others, environmental damage, whatever the case may be. So I don't know how much time we had, Mr. Chairman. I know you folks are busy. That kind of gives you an overview, at least from my perspective, but I maybe not what you were expecting. So please, if there's questions.
Thank you very much. I'll just give the committee a chance to go ahead and broaden out any questions that they want to dialogue with you is fine. I'm shooting for 3 o'clock, but if we get done early, I don't think that we'll have a rebellion on my hands.
Well, I apologize for not filling up the time, but I do want to repeat myself for several members.
Representative Rubin?
I'll yield to the other folks, and then I'll put me on the table.
Representative Millett?
I just want to commend your office and you as a new AG for being available and access to information, and you guys do a really, really good job, and I know we tend to want you to do more, but we are not attorneys. Well, some of us, excluding Max and Gabrielle, are attorneys. But so thank you for being open and visiting our offices and really giving us good advice.
Well, through the chair, thank you, Representative Benn. I'm happy to talk to any of you. Phone call away, and I'm happy to come over here and meet with you. Not an issue at all. So you're entitled to know what we're doing, and I'm happy to explain it. Thank you for those comments. So,
did I see a question, Representative?
Two areas. I've been working with Deborah Bear on several uniform acts. And I appreciate your letting her do that. The assistance and leadership she has given and the other folks who are in that organization is really helpful. I think that one thing that maybe we ought to consider, I've never suggested this before, but there are a lot of good uniform acts, and we're such a small state that we can't reinvent the wheel in all these cases. So I would be very interested in the state's suggestion on maybe somebody going through the uniform acts and seeing things that we could look at. Most of these are nonpartisan, some of them are commercial, some not. And that was the first thing. I didn't really need an answer from you on that.
Well, through the chair, for the record, Representative, I was a member. I was a Uniform Law Commissioner appointed by Governor Murkowski and served with Ms. Bear. So I was a commissioner up to the time I was appointed to this job, at which point I resigned. But I'm very familiar with the work of the commission, and I agree with your comments about the nonpartisan nature of what they do and how it's a resource for states, because they do draft very carefully legislation on subjects that legislatures might not otherwise typically address because of their complexity and so on, uniform probate code, uniform commercial code, I mean, all kinds of things. So in any event, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I would make that comment.
We have at least, I'm aware, I'm involved with two bills coming through. Anyway, the other question is something that I think I asked you about a little bit last time, and I'm just kind of flagging it for you because we'll have to have some more conversations. And that is, and this came up with the prisoner who got the razor, which is just kind of an example, but the question I'm really interested in from your point of view is the criteria the department uses to interpose the defense of executive privilege when the issue may be that there's litigation out there or potential litigation. Nothing filed yet, but there may be. And I know you're probably not prepared to really discuss this today, but I'd like to visit with you and maybe talk with the chair about this a little bit at some point. I just kind of wanted to put you on notice.
Well, but thank you, through the chair, Representative. I'd have to look into it, but I'm happy again to sit down with you at a time you're choosing and come prepared to discuss it.
Yeah, I won't put you on the spot by trying to rush this through, because it's a very important issue and worthy of some standardization, I think. Thank you.
I can't help but comment that it raises some very interesting issues, the fact that the Judicial Council and judicial conduct and the bar are so isolated in our Constitution, which we have sworn to uphold, from the pressure of the citizens of the state of Alaska. The fact that you are in an appointed position, for example, as opposed to an elected position. I'm not going to ask you what you think about this. You don't have to. But I just want to say it raises those kinds of issues, because the and it's very fascinating to me, and I spend a lot of time thinking about it and reading about it and trying to understand it. Anyway, we'll have to get a bill in to try to change maybe the life of the Judicial Council or something, and then we can have a discussion. We can just go for it, you know. Maybe we'll bring something like that forward.
So, do you say life or end of life?
Well, I'm just trying through the chair, I'm a strong proponent of our appointed attorney general, and I'm a strong proponent of how we select and pick judges and retention elections and so on. And one only needs to spend a little time in other states that elect their judges and their attorney generals to see what a stark difference it makes. And so we have an excellent judicial system and excellent bench, and a big, big proponent of it.
So we gave you the last word, I think.
Listen to the questions. I apologize for not taking more time, but I know people have heard this before, and I don't want to. And as I said, if there's any questions at all from the members of the committee, please do call me. I'd be happy to follow up. We do it on a one-on-one basis, and at your leisure.
They may have heard it before, but in some cases, not enough.
Yeah, okay.
So we'll get along 226, and thank you very much.
Thank you.